This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. Taxes was getting frustrated by your forms. Now Taxes is uploading your forms with a snap, and a TurboTax expert will do your taxes for you. One who's backed by the latest tech, which cross-checks millions of data points for absolute accuracy, all of which makes it easy for you to get the most money back guaranteed. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, I told you about our esteemed business panel. I'm going to introduce you to them now. Stephen O'Leary, he's the founder of Alitico. He's with us, as is Linda Daly, a business reporter with the Sunday Times. Good morning, one and all. How are you doing?
Morning, Bobby.
Bobby, good.
Now, Linda, I'm going to give you the floor because the first story that we're going to look at is that it's the lead in today's Irish Independent, and it's telling us that charities are now buying more homes than cuckoo funds. Tell us more.
Yeah. So according to the Independent, research of the property price register shows that of the 7 of the 10 biggest deals, residential deals last year, charities, AHBs as they're so-called, approved housing bodies, bought them. Now, first of all, before I start my rant, okay, I disagree with the word cuckoo funds, the term cuckoo funds. I don't think it's right to call investment funds cuckoo funds.
I agree with you.
Would you call Kennedy Wilson has done such great work. If you go down to Clancy Quay and see the beautiful development that's down there, they've been in the market for 10 years and they'd be considered a cuckoo fund. Right, I got that out of the way, okay? This is no surprise. This has been coming since about 2023, when investors withdrew from the market. AHBs kind of stepped in. The Sunday Times ran a story in 2023 saying, calling them superheroes. There's a kind of a bit of a feel from this article that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, because it's kind of framed as if it's a bad thing that AHBs are coming in to buy more properties and that first-time buyers are kind of being pushed
out. Well, are they not filling a need that's there?
Yes, exactly, they are. People have been calling for investment funds to get out of the market for a long time. Now they have, and it's kind of this, you know, it's flipped on its head and we're being told, oh, this is awful. Now, we need a good mix. We need first-time buyers need to be able to buy homes. That's without a doubt. But there are lots of people who need social housing. And if you get more people onto the social housing, get them into proper social homes, then you will remove the HAP, you will decrease HAP numbers, there'll be more rentals and there'll be more homes to buy.
Maybe, Stephen, I don't know what you thought of this story, but Larkin Sir has said there are questions over the model of buying completed developments for social housing. What's he actually saying there?
Yeah, and it's the, like, so the line here is it can be incredibly frustrating to people looking to buy homes to see them acquired by the state in one of its various forms of social housing.
Okay.
But this comes back to this damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, this would be a universally good story if we had better supply.
Yeah.
So the underlying problem here is the lack of supply. We saw the targets that were missed in recent weeks for the full year last year. And there's huge pressure to increase supply in 2025. But that's the reason, that's the only reason in ways this is not a universally positive story. Because the problem is there will always be a cohort who are being underserved. And in this instance, while it's great news for anyone looking for social or affordable housing, first-time buyers who sit outside that bracket rightly will feel, well, these large bodies are buying up massive blocks and we're not able to access the property. But the question becomes, well, who should the highest priority be? Who do we serve first? And the problem is when you've such a chronic lack of supply and such a backlog of development, even in a good news story like this, where we're seeing the most needy in our society getting homes and having homes built for them, there will always be other demographics who feel, well, why not us?
Yeah. Yeah, everything is interlinked, Linda, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. I suppose we need more mix, definitely. But, I mean, it's perhaps a good thing. And maybe if it is framed this way, then when the international funds come back in, people might be happy. But we definitely need more homes to sell, built to sell.
Okay. What about some worrying, I suppose, tea leaves from the central bank governor saying that he is seeing worrying signs in the European economy after the latest rate cut. So we've got problems in Europe. We've got stuff in America that we're going to come to later. And we've got a pretty volatile situation, I think, unfolding here.
We do. And the two are absolutely interconnected. You know, we're kind of like 10 days into a new administration in the US, and it's referenced in this piece in the Irish Times. This is Peter Flanagan writing and reporting on comments from the central bank governor. Now, there's an order piece here. So the changes that were made to the rates, their most recent rate cut coming on Thursday, the way it's being framed here is that those cuts are being made to try and address some of these challenges. So the hope is that not just making this cut, but signposting that further cuts are going to come, that these may help to, I suppose, kind of like stimulate the economy. Because the key concern that comes through in this is actually much less about the rates. It's much more about growth.
Yeah.
That there's a stagnancy at a European level. And you're absolutely right. There's a degree of uncertainty. So like, what's going to happen, and whether we like it or not, while Europe is very strong as a continent and as a European zone, we are so reliant and so interconnected on a global basis, particularly to the US. And right now, on a day-by-day basis, these changes are coming out of Washington, and it's really hard at a European level to predict what impact they're going to have.
And it looks like as well, Linda, that, you know, that Europe are trying to hedge their bets somewhat by saying, telling us that there's probably going to be 5 cuts this year. So, okay, here's the first of what will probably be 5. To almost soften us up for what's to come.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a juxtaposition. They raise the interest rates when the economy is probably not doing as well, and they want to kind of ease. They raise the interest rates rather to kind of ease inflation. So then we all felt the pain. Now they're easing them. People like myself, as I've spoken before on this show, delighted that the mortgage rates are coming down. But there's a reason for that, and it's because inflation is slowing. So I suppose we just all have to be a little bit careful and not go off and spend that extra money.
Yeah. We'll come back to what's happening in the US in a minute. But before we do, Stephen, just some coverage around Storm Owen. Interesting, you know, still 74,000 people still in a blackout. And a lot of, I suppose, anger around it taking so long to get back to, I suppose, what people consider normal services resumed.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting in the tone of the coverage, and this is covered across, you know, multiple newspapers this morning, and kind of no surprise with those, as you say, 74,000 people still without power. But the anger is not directed at those who are working so hard to return those kind of core utilities. So it's not directed at you know, the ESB or those in
Ayr
or others. There's an acknowledgement, in fact, that people are working around the clock. And I think one of the most incredible things in these stories are the people who have travelled from other European countries and the importance of the relationships we have with other European countries to see crews coming from France and other countries to Ireland to support the local crews with their efforts. But having said all that, there is justified criticism of a lack of preparedness at a government level. And that's been acknowledged. I think it's been called out that while there is preparation and plans in place for a range of incidents that may occur, for whatever reason, storms don't have the same thing. Now, again, you can mitigate this slightly in saying that this was a near unprecedented storm, and that the type of winds that we faced, you know, in some cases we've never seen before, certainly not in recent times. So it can be hard to predict, but that's not really an excuse.
Yeah.
There's an absolute acknowledgement, I think, on all sides that there could have been better preparation.
Linda, there's a couple of underlying, I suppose, worries here. One being the dependence of Irish water, which I hadn't realised, on electricity-related things. Things like, you know, generators and, you know, emergency infrastructure like that. Maybe we could have done a better job there. It sort of appears that we could have done. But it also then points to, you know, the way our population is, I suppose, fragmented, in that the effect on rural Ireland has been profound.
Yeah, I think people in Dublin, myself included, didn't understand when we were sitting and listening to the wind last week how detrimental it would be for people in rural Ireland. Yeah, what's shocking is Senan Maloney in the Indo, Jennifer Whitmore points out, and as Stephen alluded there, there is no storms in the National Framework Plan. Now, the reason they give that is that the local authorities look after them. But even, like, you know, I've been in the States and a text would come up on your phone to say a storm is coming. We don't even have that here.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think this reliance on social media, on local authorities rather, you then kind of, whether a local authority is good or not, you're dependent on them. I think that we need a national response, definitely.
Met Aaron seemed to have come out well out of it in terms of their forecasting. Again, you know, sometimes there's been criticism about too much information, confusion over what's red, what's orange, what's yellow. But I think they have really done a pretty good job here.
I would agree. And I think, you know, quite often it's very hard to measure the impact of that clear communication either, because quite often it's what doesn't happen. You know, it's the journeys that aren't taken. It's the people who stay inside rather than going out. There's a huge amount of potentially lives that were saved because the warnings were so significant, so severe, and so, I suppose, reiterated over the course of 48 hours. So absolutely, I think, you know, while those who are without power, those 74,000 people will rightly kind of be angry, there were people who did a really good job from a prediction point of view around this.
Yeah. Linda, a strong business story in today's Irish Times. Goodbody pursuing bid for BCP to grow asset management business. Bit of speculation here, nothing absolutely concrete, but this is an interesting business with a valuation being given here of between 12 and 14 million. Considering its turnover isn't even that.
Yeah. Yeah, look, it's perhaps no surprise that Goodbody would be circling it, and perhaps that's where the sources are coming from. BCP has gone under the radar when it comes. It has 3 billion in assets, so it's a lot of money. Goodbody has been kind of trailing against Davy for years, but only set up, I think it's 2016, it set up its wealth and asset management. So if it did take BCP in, it would add a lot to the fee income, especially then at the time when interest rates are low. So it would make sense if they buy. Now, there is also another player there, Irish Life, so it depends who gets it.
Yeah. What did you make of this story, Stephen?
Well, it's great news for BCP, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're ever trying to sell a business and you're two interested parties.
All you need is two.
Yeah, right, that helps. And I also think, you know, your point is really well made about the price relative to revenue. But the number that stood out for me was the shift from 2022 to 2023 from a profit point of view. So they posted a loss in 2022, pre-tax of 540,000. That shifted to a 925,000 plus profit in 2023. That's the kind of trajectory that makes you an attractive acquisition prospect too. So if that is a direction they're traveling in, and obviously we don't have line of sight on 2024, in a way it's no wonder you've got two major players looking to acquire them.
Yeah. Well, you got all have the numbers right to sell. You have to have the number right to get the number. Just an interesting story here by John Burns around the Intel, and, you know, as we know, Intel, hugely important from an Irish standpoint. They've been having their difficulties, and they lost their CEO at the end of last year. But the headline reads, Intel lost almost 19 billion last year, but a cost reduction plan is now completed. And this is kind of, it's part of a bigger picture, isn't it, Stephen?
It is, and again, while the headline here is staggering, I mean, a 19 billion loss is almost hard to kind of comprehend. There are reasons for optimism within this piece by John Burns. At a local level, like for Kildare, the fact that the cost reduction plan is completed is very positive. If you're employed or you're connected to the employment, and you think about all that kind of local business that generates employment in Leixlip, that's obviously particularly good news. But also, if you look at the most recent quarter, so the quarterly net loss of 126 million, that's got to be viewed in the overall number of 18.8 billion. So that's a relatively low quarterly loss and shows the positive impact. While no one wants to lose 126 million, it shows that, again, from a trajectory point of view, that they're possibly going in the right direction. But the number one challenge they face, without question, is the type of chips they're producing and the perceived gap or the actual gap that exists between them and the large data center chip production companies of this world, because that's where the demand is coming from. We see it in AI, we see it in other areas, and right now Intel are, and they've said it themselves, they're just behind the curve and they really need to accelerate in that space.
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, NVIDIA, who effectively stole their lunch, are now having their lunch being stolen.
Yeah, yeah.
which is, so it's all connected. Like, you can be, you know, the biggest part of, you know, the biggest market share, you know, and if you're number one, you know, there's a lot of people nipping at your heels. What did you think, Linda?
I suppose the story is very important from an Irish perspective.
Absolutely.
You see the impact that Intel has around Kildare and with other Irish companies that feed into it. I suppose what stood out to me was the fact that it went from a profit of $1.7 billion in 2023 to that loss of $18.8 billion.
Yeah, it's huge swing.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we certainly hope, as you say, from an Irish perspective, that they can ride it out. And as Stephen said, that the cost reductions are already in place. So let's hope it's not going to get any worse. I said we'd return to this, and I'm anxious to get your views on it. And this is the whole Trump administration, the tariffs. Canada and Mexico are bracing themselves for these tariffs that are arriving today. 25% tariffs on US neighbours, Canada and Mexico. What did you make of it, Stephen?
I think if I was to sum up this news coverage, and there's a lot of it written in the papers today, it is unintended consequences. I think that's probably what an awful lot of these stories about what are being braced as are being branded as the Trump tariffs are potentially going to have. When US elections are on, so when you're in the US political cycle, almost the key thing that everyone comes back to is how much does the gas cost? You hear it in the vox pops, you hear it in the interviews. When Joe Soap is interviewed on the street, it's like, it costs me more to fill my tank. That's why I'm voting for X or Y. And constantly we come back to it. And yet, Canada in particular is so central to the supply of crude oil, which is then refined in the US and sent to the gas station.
And I think if I'm reading it rightly, that the whatever process that they have for the refining of the crude oil, they can only really take Canada's product. They can't take other. In other words, their system is geared towards receiving Canadian crude and that they refine.
Not only that, but it's the speed with which these things can potentially change, right? So you can impose a tariff tomorrow immediately and it shoots up the cost of something. If the counter argument is, well, we'll drill our own oil and we'll build our own refineries, doesn't happen within minutes or hours. That is a multi-year project. And again, what we do know about Trump is he likes being popular. And popularity often stems from the price of gas. I can't see a situation where he would jeopardize that level of popularity by imposing
tariffs. Yeah, I think that's going to be the savior here, is if it starts to hit Americans at the pump, if it starts to hit them in the supermarket, they're going to turn on them real quick.
Yeah, the article in the Indo by Paul Wiseman says it's expected to jump from 30 cent to 70 cent. Cars up by $3,000.
Yeah, 1 in 5 cars in the US is actually built in Canada. Yeah. And yeah, that's 30% increase. And you know, if they only saw how much we pay for petrol compared, like, we pay a third of what they pay, or they pay a third of what we pay.
But yeah, that car piece too shows, like, it's such a great example of this interconnected element, right? And the potential short-sightedness of this. So while those imports from Mexico are massive, so like 1 in 5 of the cars, like you said, are built in Canada or Mexico, but it's the cross-border nature of this. The parts are being manufactured in the US, shipped to Mexico and then coming back in completed cars. Yeah. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of US manufacturing jobs on the line here too. This is not just a impose a tariff and hope for the best. There's a lot of interconnected elements.
Yeah. We'll stay in the US, Linda. Tinseltown losing its sparkle. Keith Duggan in his American letter in the Irish Times has an interesting piece today.
Yeah, he does. And I suppose what kind of hit me in it was he pointed
the number of swimming pools in LA. Did that catch your eye? 43,000.
Yeah, 43,000. Well, but it actually wasn't. the thing that really hit me. It was the fact that even despite the fires, there were very few films being made in Los Angeles when it happened. And because it just goes to show you the global nature of the film industry and all the taxes that have attracted film sectors throughout the world to Ireland. And
well, the 110 billion to the region, 700,000 jobs are the figures we've been given here.
Yeah.
But as he says, the bleak statistics are that there was just two films in production when they were interrupted by the fires. So clearly there's some challenges here, but there seems to be a nostalgia around LA that still has got currency in that it's attracting tourists, but it does seem that it's been gradually eroded.
It does. This is Keith Duggan writing in the Irish Times in his America letter. And, you know, it's a great read. And again, another reason to buy a paper this weekend, you know, for this piece alone. But that's what the industry or the city is almost clinging on to. It's this idea that it's the history of what's been there. And people are coming back for that nostalgia element. But production, it's just not happening there. So the fact that there were only two films impacted in terms of production due to the fires just shows how few are being kind of made on the ground there. And it's a, you know, it's a major challenge because so much of Hollywood's reputation is based on it's the place where the movie stars are and the movies get made.
Yeah.
And it's just no longer the case.
All right. Well, again, we hope for better times there. Now, how about a spot of light classical music that can make meals lighter too? Riveting stuff here in the Irish Daily Mail today about the correlation between classical music and eating healthy. Tell us more, Linda.
So apparently, if you listen to classical music while making your dinner, you will go for lighter choices. If you're listening to rock or jazz, you're going to stuff your face, basically.
Now I know my problem.
Exactly.
Stop
that's what I've been
to Pink
doing,
Floyd and AC/DC when you're having your dinner.
Yeah. Classical music all the way.
Stephen?
Yeah, they, you know, we often recommend you check out the Irish Times or the Independent or the Daily Mail or the Examiner and the multitude of other great newspapers and publications we have in Ireland. But they recommend the Journal of Brain Topography. So if you're looking for an interesting read this weekend, you can read the whole thing there.
All right. Well, look, as always, it's a pleasure to talk to my esteemed business panelist, Stephen O'Leary, from founder of Alitico, and Linda from the Sunday Times. Thank you, as always, for your contributions.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.
This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. Taxes was getting frustrated by your forms. Now Taxes is uploading your forms with a snap, and a TurboTax expert will do your taxes for you. One who's backed by the latest tech, which cross-checks millions of data points for absolute accuracy, all of which makes it easy for you to get the most money back guaranteed. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live full service. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.